My name is Tara Callahan, and I'm with the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Today is January 9th, 2008, and I'm here with Dr. James Schlesinger as part of the PONY Project to evaluate U.S.-UK nuclear cooperation as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Mutual Defense Agreement. Dr. Schlesinger, could you please begin by telling us about your career to date?
I was the director of strategic studies at the RAND Corporation until I joined the Nixon administration. At the RAND Corporation, I was a project leader on the study of nuclear proliferation. Joining the government, I had the responsibility in the old Bureau of the Budget for all national security problems, and then later was the deputy director, and thus had a broader set of responsibilities. After the OMB was formed out of the BOB, I went over to become the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission in 1971, where I stayed for several years conducting the nuclear test at Amchitka Island called the Kanakin to test the warhead for the Spartan missile. In 1973, I became the director of Central Intelligence, and after a very brief period at the CIA, I became the Secretary of Defense in the spring of 1973, where I stayed till 75. The follow-up to the campaign of 1976, President-elect Carter asked me to form the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy, in its Organization Act, which I prepared, absorbed the responsibilities of the Atomic Energy Commission. And that meant, of course, its nuclear responsibilities, which have been carried on steadily since that time by the Department of Energy.
Great. The MDA came at a time when the Cold War had revitalized. The MDA came at a time in history when U.S.-UK nuclear cooperation had kind of stalled after World War II. To what degree do you feel like the special relationship that evolved out of the MDA was necessitated or influenced by the onset of the Cold War and the Soviet push for nuclear weapons?
Well, of course, indirectly, the cooperation was influenced by the Cold War, since the British decided that they wanted to have an independent nuclear deterrent. And that would not have been the case if there were not the Soviet Union out there apparently threatening Britain and Western Europe. However, I think that President Eisenhower in particular, given his wartime service, felt a twinge of regret, if I may put it that way, that the cooperation that had existed during wartime with respect to nuclear matters had been so suddenly terminated by the United States at the end of the war, giving very short shrift to the British contribution. And there was a feeling that I think that we had an obligation to make amends. That was, I think, at least as important as the fact of the Cold War, that both of them were necessary in order to reach the Mutual Defense Agreement.
You were in a unique position because of your role in directly shaping nuclear defense strategy during this time. Do you feel like the British were receptive to U.S. policies during the Cold War? What ways do you feel like you differed with them on nuclear issues?
The British goal was to have a nuclear deterrent that was independent of the United States and would appear to Moscow to be independent of the United States. Therefore, for them to be wholly coalesced with U.S. strategy would have, in a sense, undermined the independence of their nuclear deterrent, which was the driving motivation for its creation. Consequently, there was never a press to have, other than all-out war, full cooperation with regard to nuclear targeting. In the nature of things, an independent nuclear deterrent, such as the British had, would target cities. And after 1960, it became our objective to avoid targeting cities so that the British deterrent necessarily would stand aside during the hypothetical early stages of a war. I should add that because the British force was small, it was not capable of counter-military targets, counter-force, going after radars and the like. It was primarily directed against cities, and they wanted to preserve that capability. With respect to overall strategy, the British, who had a very small army, tended to think of nuclear deterrence as the principal element in deterring the Soviet Union. United States policy, particularly after 1961, increasingly stressed the development of conventional forces, a solid conventional capability, which would give the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact pause before moving against the West in a hypothetical attack. The British were never very enthusiastic about that because conventional forces are expensive. And as a general proposition, the European allies, up until the time I became Secretary of Defense, were very standoffish about helping to create a conventional deterrent that would give the Warsaw Pact pause. So there was never a complete mesh with regard to nuclear strategy. The agreement really stressed cooperation with regard to technologies, materiel, sharing of information. It did not really go over to a full-blown embrace by the British of American strategy, which ultimately became NATO strategy.
Was there anything specifically that was restricted under the MDA?
I beg your pardon?
Was there any area of cooperation that was specifically restricted by the MDA? Technology that couldn't be shared, or what were the limits of cooperation?
The limits of cooperation, which from time to time were stretched. Supposedly, we were not supposed to do anything in the way of helping the British to design nuclear weapons. There was no reason that we could not trade nuclear materials. And I think, as is well known, the United States had a surplus of oralloy, which the British ultimately needed, most notably when they began to field a submarine fleet. And the United States was from time to time short of plutonium. So we had material swaps with the British. That was not in any way precluded by agreement. The basic legal restraint under the Atomic Energy Act was design information. And I might add, not under the Atomic Energy Act, the design for submarine propulsion, which became essential saw the British as their V-bomber force aged and they moved towards submarines.
Do you think the MDA contributed to British support for our Cold War policies? Do you think it helped, the special partnership helped pave the way for further cooperation?
Well, the special relationship, I think, was forged during World War II, that the MDA, in a sense, was a byproduct of that, that the MDA was not a driving force behind the cooperation between the British and the United States. It was a reflection of that cooperation. It was a reflection of wartime association, most particularly in the case of General Eisenhower, who led a combined British-American army into Europe. In that period, there was no alternative, of course, to American Cold War policies. The United States was the big power within the NATO alliance. Without the United States, the NATO alliance was weak. And as a consequence, there was no alternative. The British accepted this quite willingly. Other members of the alliance were more reluctant to go along, in particularly France after Charles de Gaulle became president in 1958.
That's another question I wanted to ask. Do you think that the special partnership we have with Great Britain could have happened with any other country?
Special partnerships are not created by contractual agreement. They are, in a sense, organic growth for the American society, particularly in that era. Britain was regarded as the mother country. It was Britain that gave the United States most of its institutions. So it is very hard to think of other countries in which we could have had so close a relationship. One could argue the Dutch, who played an instrumental role in the development of North America, might be so considered. And the Dutch, the Low Countries, were very close to the United States during the buildup of NATO. We tended to rely politically to a large extent on the Low Countries. But there was only the British in which we had this institutional, organic, emotional relationship.
As Secretary of Defense under Nixon, you proposed modernizing strategic military doctrine and programs. Do you think Great Britain contributed at all in modernizing our nuclear arsenal? And in what ways do you think that they helped?
As I mentioned a moment ago, the British really adhered to the notion that we announce that if the Soviet Union decided to move westward, that there would be a nuclear response, and that would be a sufficient deterrent. The British did not necessarily embrace, at least initially, changes in strategic doctrine. Ultimately, the Germans were more willing to embrace those changes for reasons that I can come to. But the British were slow to embrace those changes. The reason behind the change in nuclear doctrine in the 1970s, and particularly under President Nixon, was that by the latter 1970s, the Soviet Union had developed a counter-deterrent and thus held American cities prospectively at hostage. And as Charles de Gaulle repeatedly challenged, will the Americans exchange New York for Hamburg? There had to be an adequate answer to that question so that the Soviet Union would never be tempted to move conventionally against Western Europe? And the answer was a change in strategic doctrine, in which we announced that the strategic forces of the United States were thoroughly integrated into the defense of Western Europe, and that as a consequence of that, the United States would respond if our conventional forces were overwhelmed with nuclear attacks on the Soviet Union itself. That was a change in policy, and that we would go after economic targets or military targets, that there would be a selective response with nuclear weapons. The Soviets didn't like the change in announced policy. But up until that time, much of the discussion of nuclear deterrence consisted of not attacking the Soviet Union in the event of an attack on Western Europe, but to implement SACEUR's, a Strategic Allied Commander Europe, strike plan, which basically targeted targets in Eastern Europe.
And what was the British response to this change in doctrine?
They showed little enthusiasm at the outset. I think that it was only after a while that the British came around, and the Europeans generally came around. The experience that the European allies had had in the 1960s was that when Secretary McNamara began to talk about conventional defense in Western Europe, the Europeans interpreted it, possibly correctly, that he was trying to substitute conventional defense for the nuclear deterrent. And since they felt themselves dependent on the nuclear deterrent, they did not like that at all. In the latter 1970s, or the middle 1970s, when I was Secretary of Defense, I stressed the fact that there were three legs of deterrence: the strategic forces of the United States in particular, the tactical nuclear weapons that were forward deployed, and the conventional, and that they were all bound together, that they were not intended to substitute for one another, but instead to reinforce one another. And once the Europeans, including the British, saw that we were not trying to take away the nuclear deterrent, they were prepared to go along. But they didn't build up their conventional forces. You will remember that the British Army on the Rhine, the BAOR, spent half of its time in Northern Ireland attempting to put down the Troubles in Northern Ireland. So even though the British Army was a highly qualified force, it was not deployed consistently in Germany. And the British accepted the change in strategy once they saw that it improved deterrence. But they were not enthusiastic initially.
What level of control did the U.S. have over nuclear weapons in Great Britain, and what was the role for these nuclear weapons? You kind of discussed that a little bit earlier, but...
I'm sorry.
What level of control? Yeah.
The United States exercised control over all of its own nuclear weapons that were forward deployed in European countries. Some of the European countries felt that they should have a say, a strong say, if not a veto, on the use of such weapons. What some of them might have referred to as a two-key system. I think that I think that the British were fully satisfied that the United States would never use weapons that were based in Britain itself against an attack from the East, unless there was concurrence by the Her Majesty's government.
How did you deal with the nuclear information sharing that was part of the special relationship? Can you tell me what degree of openness there was in technology and research between the U.S. and U.K.?
It was, at the personal level, a very open relationship, a good deal of camaraderie. But there were restraints with regard to the exchange of information, particularly, as I mentioned earlier, that the Atomic Energy Act sought to avoid any information with regard to weapons design. Ultimately, in the other areas, the hesitancy was overcome. Admiral Rickover, for example, was initially reluctant to allow his own creations with regard to nuclear propulsion for submarines to be shared with anybody else. But ultimately, that information was shared, and as I indicated, was not precluded by the Atomic Energy Act. In addition, we have discussions of material, fissile material production. In that area, that there was little barriers. It was principally in the area of weapons design in which the United States was inhibited, and the British understood the inhibitions under American law.
Now, you're in a unique position because you've been both head of the chairman of the AEC and Secretary of Defense, so you've had a large role in not only policy, but in the scientific aspect of nuclear weapons as well. As someone in that role, can you describe the interplay or the interchange between those two areas, and how does that affect the special relationship?
Well, the relationship with the British was like no other. And therefore, it's hard to talk about policy and science in separate categories, because we are dealing with a bunch of people who had warm relationships with each other on the science side, and that to some extent they were precluded by U.S. law from full disclosure with regard to certain aspects of weapons. But with regard to any other science matters, there tended to be full cooperation. And that was a reflection of existing policy.
Do you believe that levels of cooperation were different in the different areas that you worked in, as far as the AEC, DOE, and then also being Secretary of Defense? Did the special partnership seem to change according to the organization, or do you think it was just primarily driven by personal relationships?
It depends what level one is talking about. Obviously, there were bureaucratic relationships between people from the AEC, subsequently the Department of Energy, and their British counterparts. They were dealing also, of course, with the Ministry of Defense over there, so that there was a DOD oversight. Those were important relationships, and one can never forget the bureaucratic relationships. They are essential in making things work. On the other hand, personal relationships were very important too. Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State, I think he was still just the National Security Advisor at that point. He was just the National Security Advisor. But he had warm relationships with the British, and those personal relationships spilled over elsewhere. And they were not inhibited by organizational constraints. For example, when the Soviets began to deploy their ABM system around Moscow, the British became quite concerned that the Polaris missiles that they had would not penetrate those defenses. So in that period, even though I was the director of Central Intelligence rather than and part of the Defense Department, I was sent over to the to London to inform the British with regard to penetration capabilities, vulnerabilities of the Soviet ballistic missile defense system, and what was necessary to penetrate them. Ultimately, to be sure, the British moved into the Poseidon missile so that we had, so that they had MIRV warheads, and that those MIRV warheads would be able to penetrate what was a relatively primitive ABM system that the Soviets had deployed. Nonetheless, the British in that period, 1973, needed some reassurance with regard to what they had invested very substantial sums in creating an independent nuclear deterrent that might be thwarted by Soviet ballistic missile defense systems.
Are there any British counterparts you recall working with particularly? What was it like on a personal level for you?
I have reached the stage in life that I cannot recall names. So you will just have to, that's a disease characterized by the British historian by the name of A.G.P. Taylor as nominal amnesia. You can't remember names. So that's 30-odd years ago, and I'm sure if I saw them today, I would recognize them. But if you ask me what were the names, you would have to provide me with a list of my counterparts.
Do you have any experiences that you remember where you had specifically a positive exchange with British personnel? Or?
I do. By the way, I do remember Sir John Hill from that period, who was the head of the AEA, the Atomic Energy Authority, and some of the others. When I was chair of the Atomic Energy Commission, they took me up to Dounreay, up at the top of Scotland, in order to see President Nixon and Prime Minister Heath had agreed on further cooperation with respect to what is the term? The nuclear reactors that produce more material than they consume. What is the term? I forget. President Nixon and Prime Minister Heath had agreed early in 1971 or early 72 that there would be full cooperation with respect to the construction of breeder reactors. So that as chairman of the AEC, I found myself flying up to the top of Scotland to see the British reactor, breeder reactor construction. It ultimately was a failure. The American reactor at Clinch River was ultimately squashed. Breeder reactors have never quite come to life. There is hope that they may come to life in the future, but that it was trips like that to the top of Scotland that stick in my mind.
Is there any specific tensions that you recall with?
I bet you our British counterparts can tell you more about my tours in the UK than I can recall.
Can you recall any tensions that you had with British personnel?
Pardon?
Any tensions or disagreements that you had with your British counterparts?
No. We had, when I was Secretary of Defense, and we had the U.S. intervention in the Middle East at the same time that the Heath government was wholly opposed to the United States assisting Israel. We had some tensions, but that was in a different area than with regard to nuclear matters.
How do you think being such close nuclear allies affects other areas of foreign policy, as you were discussing? How do you think our nuclear relationship affects other areas of policy between Great Britain and the U.S.?
As I just mentioned, the relationship got a little testy at the time of the Middle Eastern War of 1973. The testiness lasted for a while. But the British, temperamentally, or part of national character perhaps, are the ultimate realists. They do not spend a lot of time sulking. They look for areas to agree upon rather than areas to disagree. That was in contrast to our French friends, who by that time not only were prepared to look for those areas to disagree on, but areas about which they could sulk.
Do you think you witnessed the relationship evolve over time? And in what way? You said that we changed our strategic doctrine during the Cold War and that the British had to get on board. In what ways do you think our relationship with them changed after the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Well, the first point to be made is that after World War II, the nations of Western Europe were in a severely weakened condition at the time that the United States had over half of the world's manufacturing capacity. There was a worldwide shortage of dollars, and the United States supplied dollars to other countries, which meant that we had, some benign influence over them. It took a while, I think, both for the Americans and the Europeans to recognize how the balance of strength had changed. For example, President Eisenhower, even as late as the early 1950s, thought that the Europeans could regain their strength and provide a bulwark against the Soviet Union. That never materialized. Europe, the European nations collectively, had been so weakened. And as a result, gradually, both sides of the Atlantic came to understand that the overall predominance of the United States, and therefore the greatest weight with regard to formulating strategies, formulating policies, inevitably came to Washington. That brings us to 1991 and the collapse of the Soviet, the ultimate collapse of the Soviet Union. Of course, the Soviet Empire began to disintegrate in 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down. But the basic collapse of the Soviet Union and the disintegration into its component parts meant that the Soviet threat, the Warsaw Pact threat, clearly had disappeared, and that the Europeans felt no longer the same need for American protection. And as a result, there was another phase in which there was much greater independence on the part of the Europeans as opposed to the Cold War period.
Some people have argued that the British nuclear deterrent...
I beg pardon?
Some people say the British nuclear deterrent is affected negatively by its reliance on the United States. And what effect do you think this question of independence has had during your career on perspective or perception and decision-making for both countries?
Let's see now, are we into the next page?
Yeah, we're on question 17. Does the question of independence of the British nuclear deterrent matter perceptually and strategically, I guess?
I don't think so. I believe that the British never had any difficulty in expressing very strong views with regard to American policy. Perhaps that was at its greatest level when Mrs. Thatcher was prime minister. Despite the well-known Thatcher-Reagan partnership, when she had a strong view about what we were doing, she expressed it in unmistakable terms. I do not think that the notion that Britain was at all weakened by the United States. You must remember that much of the work on the nuclear deterrent itself was carried on at lower levels of government, and they went on even if there were frictions at higher levels of government. The British were testing their weapons out in Nevada. I forgot to mention testing as one of the areas of cooperation, since the Australians no longer seemed to be eager to provide places in their own desert for the British test, which had been the case initially. And those things went on. They were handled for the most part at lower levels, and there was no interference. The British nuclear deterrent and its partial dependency on the United States simply saved Britain a great deal of money that could be used for other purposes, including other defense purposes with which they worked cooperatively with the United States.
Do you think the U.S. moratorium on nuclear testing evened the playing field between Great Britain and the U.S.?
I beg pardon?
Do you think it evened the playing field when the U.S. Put a moratorium on nuclear testing between Great Britain and the U.S. in areas of nuclear development?
Needless to say, the British have always been happier with the absence of nuclear testing than the United States has. The United States has never signed the ratified the Comprehensive Test Ban Agreement, which the British are inclined to urge us to do, but they don't make a federal case of it. fact that no one, or at least no one in the West has been testing, of course, removes that particular area of dependency on the United States, and it could have some psychological effect in the UK. If so, it seems to me to be more imaginative than real.
What's your advice for the new generation of U.S. policymakers in the nuclear realm, especially regarding how to manage the special partnership?
Repeat that.
What is your advice for future U.S. policymakers in the nuclear realm, especially in regards to the special partnership?
Well, special partnership is dependent upon factors that go well beyond the nuclear relationship. As long as we have a close and intimate relationship with the UK, the nuclear relationship will not be affected. My own advice with regard to the principles is that the in this era in which we see more and more efforts on the part of some other nations to break out of the constraints of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and to develop their own nuclear capabilities, we see the efforts. We see also, even in the case that there are no efforts that we can observe, the temptations. That the cooperation between Britain and the United States, which once was a cause of jealousy, is no longer such a cause. It is accepted by the outside world, and it is a relationship that should be fostered. The nuclear relationship and the relationship with regard to intelligence exchanges between ourselves and the British, I would say, are twin pillars which support the overall political relationship. I sometimes read comments from the UK or even comments by people who should know better in the United States that the British get nothing out of the relationship. And when I think about both what the British have saved and what they have obtained, both in the intelligence relationship and in the nuclear relationship, that strikes me just as preposterous.
What do you predict is going to be the future of nuclear weapons and NATO, especially with regards to the U.S. relationship with the U.K.?
Where are we now?
It's question 22.
Well, we sometimes hear about the need to have a world free of nuclear weapons. The greatest barrier to the spread of nuclear capabilities continues to be the extended deterrence provided by the United States, both in Europe and in Northeast Asia, and possibly in Southwest Asia as well. To the extent that certain persons talk about the United States getting rid of its nuclear capabilities in a world without nuclear weapons, all that they will do would be to stimulate additional efforts on the part of others to acquire nuclear capabilities for their own self-protection. That is particularly true with regard to NATO. As we know, the Germans ever since World War II and the Treaty of West European Union are precluded from seeking nuclear weapons. That is a legal barrier that is, that would be weakened if the Germans did not feel that the U.S. and nuclear umbrella were over their heads. And what applies to Germany applies, I think, more broadly to the other NATO countries, including some of the new admissions to NATO. It has never, the role of the United States in Western Europe and in NATO has never adversely affected the relationship between the United States and the UK, which is has a degree of intimacy that exceeds that within the NATO alliance, and I see no reason why that should ever come to an end.
What do you see as the prospects for partnership in the future in areas of civilian nuclear energy as Great Britain starts to develop further their civilian energy program?
Well, we've had partnerships in the past. As I mentioned, there was an attempt back there in the early 70s by President Nixon and Prime Minister Heath to develop a R&D partnership with respect to breeder reactors. That collapsed not because of the political relationship, but simply because the technology proved to be too difficult and too expensive for both parties to carry on at that time. In this period, the British, as they turn to additional nuclear reactors, are looking, I think, at the same set of nuclear designs as everyone else is. Westinghouse design, the Areva, so-called European reactor, the Areva reactor. The British, I think, have had a very sour experience with regard to designing their own reactors, in that some have been have not worked very well, and some have proved to be vastly more expensive than was true elsewhere, and they have become inclined to depend on the designs worldwide and to select the best of them rather than try to have an indigenous design capability. And I think that that will, is the present inclination of the British government and likely to continue to be.
Are there any last kind of anecdotes you have that kind of specifically invoke the special relationship for you personally?
I think that the, as I mentioned earlier, when I went over to London in 1973 to share our assessments of the Soviet ABM system around Moscow, the capacity to penetrate it and so forth, was, at least for me, the most revealing example of the intimate relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. And at the time, as I said, I was neither in the Department of Defense nor in the Department of Energy and its predecessors, but I was simply the Director of Central Intelligence.
When you went to Scotland, did anything specifically surprise you about the way you were greeted by your British counterparts?
As I mentioned, sometime during the period of the Middle Eastern War of 1973, relations became, at least temporarily, a little testy, but that had nothing whatsoever to do with my counterparts in the nuclear area at any time. They were always very warm.
What are your personal opinions about U.S.-UK nuclear cooperation? What do you think this will look like in 50 years?
Depends. That depends on the overall relationship. What we see at the present time is an erosion of national sovereignty, particularly in Europe, of a belief in national sovereignty that has gone much further, let's say, in Germany than it has in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom itself is under some stress, and you now have the in the Scottish Parliament a body that wants to achieve independence from Britain. It is very hard in these rapidly changing circumstances to project what the world will be like in 50 years' time. We see in the European states that they have great difficulty in funding their welfare states, that they have great difficulty in assimilating the Muslim populations, which has resulted in changed internal attitudes. I trust that the shared values of Western civilization will continue to predominate for all of us 50 years hence, but I cannot be certain on that score. And the world could undergo sufficient change that the close relationships that we've had with Europe, even with Britain, could be undermined.
So just to wrap up, from a broader perspective, what do you conceptualize is the role of nuclear weapons in the world? And how do you see that changing?
As I mentioned, there are some people who fantasize about a world without nuclear weapons. They are fantasizing. Once you discover the technology, there's no way that you can expunge that knowledge from the mind of man. And as a consequence, even if we have reduced reliance on nuclear weapons, which we have today, certainly in our defense strategies, they are always there in the background, and they can never be entirely driven away. As the Western world shrinks in relation to the outside world, as Asia becomes increasingly important both in economic and political terms, there may be a sense that it is necessary for us to embrace once again a reliance on nuclear weapons. I am not predicting that, but I certainly think that it is a possibility. The world that we've had since 1991 with the breakup of the Soviet Union has been, from the standpoint of an earlier worry about nuclear war, a period of great relaxation in that there is not the same kind of external threat. And for the most part, the United States, which and NATO have dominance in the conventional area, which they did not, conventional military area, which they did not feel that they had while the Soviet Union and the Western and the Warsaw Pact were around. So as long as that's the case, we can rely less on nuclear weapons as part of our strategy, but they can never go away. And in part, this is due to the fact that there are all sorts of aspirants out there, both state actors and non-state actors, that aspire to acquire weapons of mass destruction. That has been an objective of Al-Qaeda for many years, and that in light of that fact, we must be alert to the changing scene in the nuclear area.
How do you think the U.S. and the U.K. can further cooperation to make sure that they prevent terrorists from acquiring nuclear capability?
The U.S. and the U.K. will continue to exchange information. none of these democracies have shown a convincing dedication to providing protection against these external threats. In part, they're trying to balance civil liberties against the crackdown that may be required with regard to these kinds of terrorist threats. And in that regard, Britain, with its long tradition of tolerance, is perhaps a weak link in that Britain continues to be a place that tolerates and harbors people who are hostile not only to this country, but are hostile to Britain itself, which provides them with their sustenance.
All right. Those are all the questions I have. So thank you so much for coming and sharing your personal experiences and your perspective on the U.S.-UK Special Nuclear Partnership. Thank you for coming.